party people, what's happening? Welcome to another episode of the Avocado Gamescast, a podcast about five friends living, working, and laughing in the greatest city in the world, Los Angeles. This week, we're brought to you by The Yellow Spoon, a totally rad, healthy meal kit service that's disrupting the delivery industry. It only costs twice as much as my rent, so it's a great deal. Move over, Grubhub. Baby, let's spoon tonight. All right, coming up, we're going to share our best stories about being stuck in traffic at Wilshire and Sepulveda, our best stories about being stuck in traffic at Sunset and Highland, and our best stories about challenge video games, which is kind of like being stuck in traffic at Adams and Figueroa. Am I right?
You are not wrong.
All right, but first let's introduce ourselves. My name's Merv, and I'm an aspiring screenwriter. Joining me, she's an aspiring screenwriter, it's Admirax.
Hey, party people. City of Angels, baby.
Yeah. He's an aspiring screenwriter. It's the Kappa.
I don't even like to pretend to be from LA. I'm not even going to lie with you guys.
She's an aspiring screenwriter. It's Lovely Bones.
It's not an accurate descriptor, you know, technically.
Fair enough. And finally, making his podcast debut, he's an aspiring screenwriter. It's Godzilla.
Hey, sorry I was late. I got stuck in LA traffic.
Oh, don't we know it?
Yeah, because we are five friends who live, work, and laugh in LA.
I did find that intro funny because I did actually used to live on Fig when I lived in LA.
Oh gosh,
I live in LA right now. I have to drive down Fig fairly often. It's not fun. Not a great road.
I have a lot of family and friends in LA, and I don't envy them. There's a reason I don't visit them as much as I should.
My girlfriend went to LA and she said we're not allowed to go to LA.
The thing about LA is that it's way more fun to live there than it is to visit.
That's very fair.
Yeah, it's weirdly not as touristy as you would expect for its fame. Like there's Hollywood and Santa Monica and then Disneyland, which is pretty far out of LA, and that's about it.
Yeah.
But great food scene. That's like fantastic. Me sincerely speaking, not like fake podcast Merv.
I feel like you get good food scenes everywhere, but okay.
Like I'm saying this having lived in a bunch of cities now, it's probably my favorite food scene out of all the cities I've lived in. Worst traffic though.
Having lived both there and in Seattle, I'm saying Seattle's starting to give LA a run for its money.
Ooh. Shots fired. I mean, I'm not invested in LA. I've only been here for like 2 years. All right. So, Kappa, you've been watching some weird stuff on Twitch lately.
I hope it's not weird. I hope it becomes the new normal because I am bored of Fortnite. honestly, GTA 5 roleplay is what I'm going to talk about. It's not that new. Speaking of Fortnite, it kind of was becoming its own thing right about the time or even before Fortnite kind of took over what streaming became. So I think you ended up with this weird transition where basically everybody got into Fortnite, right? I mean, everybody who streamed Fortnite for a long time. But before that, GTA 5 was really starting to kind of come into its own. It was this weird, quirky thing. Maybe the tech's not quite there yet for what it is or what the community wants it to be, but it's slowly but surely getting there. And what I was finding was there's a lot of creativity, a lot of people trying to do a lot of fun stuff. And then it kind of petered out. And depending on who you ask, now I'm going to say this, there's a lot of debate in the community about what is or what isn't good RP. And that's kind of what killed the first more or less iteration of GTA 5 RP, according to most people, was bad RP. And watching more and more of the streams, I'm starting to find out what everybody considers good and bad RP is kind of debatable. Best way I can describe what I've been watching, what I've been enjoying, is kind of like a good improv class.
Okay, so it's a little bit like a Kishis, like unscripted Red versus Blue almost?
Yes, and what you want to do is you want to let the situation go in kind of natural ways and natural levels of craziness, but they want to rein it in. They don't want it to be so ridiculous that it feels like it isn't something that would happen, And so I've noticed a lot of what people are saying or calling is bad RP is also getting these terms thrown around called power gaming and metagaming. In other words, you're trying to win rather than trying to further the story or have fun. The best way I could explain this is if you've ever been to anything like improv, it'd be like trying to be the funniest person of the improv group rather than letting everybody else get their jokes in. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the streamers I've really been enjoying, I'm going to have to try to remember their stream names as well as their character names. But one example of somebody I think who really, I guess, does it right, if you're looking to get into the scene, the streamer, her name is Ashlyn, A-S-H-L-Y-N-N, and she streams a hospital receptionist named Brenda. Sounds boring, right? I mean, it sounds like, why would anyone spend time watching this? And then you watch it and you realize kind of what the genius is of GTA 5 RP, where you've basically got this character who lives this super mundane life, right? But crazy stuff happens around her and to her in, you know, like kind of a GTA way. I should say that, you know, there is some stuff out there that I don't necessarily find enjoyable when it comes to GTA RP. A lot of people really take the GTA part a little too far. Too many cops, too many robbers, you know, that part of it. I think I find it a little boring, honestly.
But the so people many heists and shit.
Yeah, but so one of the downfalls or side effects of the game getting as popular as it is, I feel like, is that you're starting to see a lot of the big streamers come in and come through and kind of start to power game. You know, my character is a bank robber, and if you don't like it, too bad, but that's what he does. He robs all the banks, and, you know, it's not fun to watch because all of a sudden you've got a guy with 40K streamers, I'm talking about Summit, who's competing against people with, you know, 1,000, 2,000 viewer channels. And the pressure is there for the 1,000, 2,000 viewer channels to kind of go along with him and almost let him win, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Which kind of weakens the RP because all of a sudden you got this big dog in this little pond kind of pushing his way into it. I think you're seeing a lot of growing pains right now in the community. If I had to guess, you know, with what do we do now that it's popular and we've got big people, you know, big people as in, you know, viewer count streamers. Doing this again. So that's kind of where it's at right now. But I would say besides Ashlyn, if you want to check out some other ones, her name is Remy the Siren with an I. She role plays Amara, who's just a ambulance driver and who does interact with some of the crazy, you know, criminals and stuff like that through her job, but does it in a really cool way. She's not the one trying to arrest them. She's more the one trying to get them, you know,
to the hospital.
Yeah, exactly. So she kind of just role plays that. If you're looking a little more for the cop and robber side, I've enjoyed a guy named Ziggy. He's basically the cop, that a lot of people enjoy. But one important note about cops is they're not just cops. They're basically server admins as well. So beyond just enforcing stuff like, you know, speeding laws and things like that in Los Santos, they're also there to kind of enforce, hey, this is how this would break out or break down in certain situations. So I think that's kind of an interesting perspective to watch it from. There's another guy, Mick Da Infamous, who role plays basically a 70-year-old grandmother. Absolutely hilarious. She's involved in crime. She's the leader of the she's the leader of the Prune Gang, which I think is probably the funniest thing I've ever heard.
I love so crime grandmas.
What I would say is I guess right now what I'm really enjoying about it is it feels like it's the beginning of like a community. Most of these people have only been streaming on this server. It's called the No Pixel server. It operates under a very weird rule set. Some of the tech, some of the stuff they have to do is a little weird. I mean, it's not all straightforward. Obviously, GTA 5 is not a role-playing platform, you know? So they've had to mod the server heavily. The guy who does it, he streams as well. His name is Coyle. He's probably the head programmer of it all, and you can watch his stream not just for his hijinks and stuff, but it'll also pop in, it'll show you how to code a vehicle so that people can access things from the trunk, for example. So that level of tech is in there if you're interested in that as well. So I mean, overall, it's a really cool scene right now. I think you're going to find a lot of people who do and don't get RP in different ways. There's going to be a lot of offensive, you know, kind of stereotyping type stuff out there, because I feel like that's a fallback. You know, I think for anybody who learns or does bad, you know, improv, that's always been kind of a fallback. Sometimes, you know what I mean? Like where it's like, okay, I'm going to do the really obvious Asian accent or you know, stuff like that. But generally speaking, I mean, you've got people who you know, are doing it who are of the, you know, the group that they're portraying. So it's just more like, this is how my dad talks and I want to play an older Asian guy. So that's what I'm doing, you know, which I think is a little more tolerable for most people. But it's really cool. Find the streamers you like. There's plenty of them out there. You got people, I mean, doing all the jobs, all the things from as high stress to as low stress as you want. And it's almost like watching a TV channel. And when it all clicks and the role play is really going well, I feel like, you know, it's just as enjoyable as a TV show. There's just as much emotion. I mentioned two streamers, Amara and Brenda. There's kind of a will they, won't they type moment between them. And, you know, like a little bit of chemistry going on and a lot of, you know, are they in love or are they just workplace friends type thing going on that really had a kind of a sad payoff where, you know, it didn't totally work for them. But you can watch all this through their video on demand on Twitch if you're interested. So yeah, that's what I've been spending way too much of my time doing. And when I talk to people about it, they have no idea what I mean. So I guess this is kind of my advertisement for if you haven't started and you want to get in on something, now would kind of be the time to start following some of the storylines if you're interested.
It's such a completely different world from the kind of video gaming content I usually watch on the internet. I typically watch things like, you know, video podcasts, a roundtable discussion. Sometimes I'll watch Let's Plays. This is a whole other world that I'm not really used to. But, you know, like Machinima is not a super young medium. This is just right. Kind of pushing it even farther.
Yeah, and I think kind of in a natural direction where you're letting people who are good do as much as they want with the server tools that they're given. And I think that's the tech part of it to me is almost just as interesting as some of the other stuff. I mean, the fact that they've like hard coded stances for cops to stand in that very much look like how a cop would stand. You know what I'm talking about? Like that's the kind of stuff I find really interesting in what they've spent their time doing. So yeah, it's kind of in a cool spot right now. And if you're just more interested in, you know, following the storylines, that's there. If you're interested in following the tech or how they're making it all work, that's all there. And the people I would say that are big streamers, I don't want you to get the wrong impression of them. They're not necessarily bad, but they're just doing they're looking for the next thing and the next thing and the next thing and the next thing, because these guys have to provide the content, you know?
Yeah.
So a lot of times when they pop into these things and they feel it, there's a reason they're taking their 40,000 viewers there, and it's not because they don't think it's going to work out. So hopefully it sticks around for a little bit. Like I said, I'm bored of Fortnite, bored of lots of the streaming that's kind of become the standard stuff. So hopefully this is kind of the new thing for a little bit. And yeah, check it out if you're interested at all in kind of seeing a weird video game role play in its infancy.
Yeah, I'm curious. I want to see what's going on. I don't know if I'll be like hardcore into it, but you never know. I might just watch one video and then go down a rabbit hole. That happened to me.
That's pretty much what happened to me. What I'd say is maybe start following one or two characters and then see who they interact with the most that you like. Do you know what I mean? So like I started following one of the streamers I follow, who's actually a scam baiter most of the time. His name's Kit Boga. He started interacting with this character named Gladys, the grandmother, who I thought was really funny. So I started following her. Then I started following most of the Prune Gang. Then they had an interaction in the hospital, and one of them got shot, and I met Brenda. And I think that's kind of how it just generally works, as you start to find all these people. And the community in general is really good, really positive. They're very supportive, very good about hosting each other and kind of spreading the love. And if somebody starts to kind of get big, they're doing a great job of saying, okay, well, you know, you guys like me, but I'm going to go interact with maybe this person who I think deserves to be bigger, but doesn't necessarily have the audience right now. So let me, you know, basically kick them over, you know, some views and see if I can share that. And that's good to see, I think, in a new-ish streaming community where it's not how you're my viewers, you're my subs, I'm keeping you. Too bad for everybody else.
That's good to see. It's good to see a supportive streaming community in Twitch. You know, for all the guff we give it and all the horrible content that's on there, generally it's a pretty supportive community. So
maybe I don't know. I'm not a fan of Twitch. If this took place literally anywhere else, I'd be happier. But I think what's potentially going to ruin this is not so much the streamers, but the chat.
Chat is awful. Like that's a whole other thing.
And they tend to have this thing where what they do is if they don't like what you're doing to their favorite character, they go to your stream and tell you about it. You know what I mean? So if you're a cop who arrested their favorite heister, because he broke the law in a stupid way and got caught. They're going to go over to your stream and they're going to tell you about it. You know what I mean? And they're going to call you a fail RPer and a bad RPer, and you don't know the game, and you should just let him have his fun. And that kind of sucks. You know what I mean? If anything's going to happen, that's going to wear down the people who are really trying to make a difference. And it's mostly the cops, honestly, who have to deal with that. Because if you think about it, they're the ones who are the bad guys in almost every situation, right? Everybody wants the
criminals to like run amok. Or,
exactly. Yeah. That's way more fun, but the cops at the same time, they have to keep it fun for everybody, because it's not fun if, you know, you work at the bank and the bank is constantly getting robbed, you know? Yeah. I think that if anything's going to kind of be the downfall, it's going to be the chats kind of taking over and influencing and putting their will into everything. So, but yeah, that's GTA 5 RP. That's what I've been spending a lot of my time on. And, you know, check it out. I think most of the streamers I mentioned, Ashlyn, Amara, Infamous, Mick the Infamous, those are all kind of good places to start if you're looking for different things. Right. Ziggy as well.
I'll check it out at some point. Lovely Bones, what have you been playing?
But before this recording started, I was on the open thread and I saw you make a comment about, you know, just the standard joke about like backlog or having a lot of games that you're playing in the, or that you're in the middle of right now. And it made me laugh because it is insane how true that is for me right now. I'm not going to talk about all of them in detail, but I just do want to provide a quick list because it's amusing to me at least. So I just started Super Mario World with Library Lass because right. I finished the Mario Bros. The NES trilogy. So I'm moving on to the SNES. I'm in the middle of Resident Evil 4. I'm playing Bloodborne.
Ooh.
I'm also playing Rayman Legends. There's also games I've mentioned on previous episodes that I'm still not finished with, like Mario Galaxy. it's a mess. But I'm going to talk about Bloodborne because it's what I'm most excited about right now, and also because it's relevant to kind of our main discussion topic for later. So I started Bloodborne last weekend. Yeah, I've been playing it for about a week, and I am having a blast with it. It is really fun. last night, I played for about 3 hours, and I moved from like the first main area where you have the first two bosses to the second main area, which is the Cathedral Ward and Old Yharnam, which kind of share an occupied space, and Old Yharnam is kicking my ass in the best way.
So this is one of those games where it's kind of fun to get your ass beat over and over.
I had a really good time with it. Like, there was very little negative feeling about it for the most part, although I do have a very good story. Okay, so I did like only like two or three raids on Old Yharnam before I just like, okay, I've literally depleted my backlog of blood vials and bullets, so I have to go replenish that. but I lost about 8,000 blood echoes in the process, which are, you know, if you've played a From Software game, you know how that works. It's the Souls system of just like of what you use for leveling up and for buying stuff in shops and whatever.
It's like XP / money.
Yeah, no, it's XP and money in one, but if you die while you have a lot of it, you only have one chance to go and retrieve it, or else it's lost to the ether. And yeah, I lost about 8,000 of those.
Ooh, yeah, that's not good.
That's no one's favorite part of these games.
Reminds me of, and you're gonna probably hate me for saying this, that reminds me of Sonic's Rings.
Oh god.
I can't play.
Stop trying to force it. Stop trying it. I see what's coming.
All right, okay. I'm gonna back off from that comparison. Sorry, you were saying about
Sonic and his many rings, which apparently work as like teleportation devices in the movie.
we'll worry about that movie.
Yeah,
when it comes
we'll
out.
We'll worry about that later, though. So there's this one part of so Old Yharnam is like this destroyed, dilapidated community that's under the main city, right? Like there's basically no civilization left there. It's just the ruins of a lost community full of monsters. And there's two hunters. They're just like the guardians of these ruins, and they don't let other hunters come in because the monsters aren't hurting anyone. They don't leave their ruins. So hunters coming in and just slaughtering them for harvest is not really cool to them. And they're very good about protecting their territory because they have a fucking Gatling gun.
Ooh.
A Gatling gun turret mounted on this high tower that they just tear through you with. And there was this one part during my time in Old Yharnam. I made really good progress with it. Like, I opened shortcuts through the labyrinth of nonsense so that, you know, I won't have to go through all the same monsters over and over again anymore. There was this one part where I was just so frenzied, emotionally frenzied. Frenzy is actually an attribute in the game, but I meant my emotional state was so frenzied and so stressed that there was a solid minute where I forgot what the heal button was.
So you're just kind of like running around in a circle saying, please don't hit me, please don't hit me.
No, like, there were two monsters in front of me, and I had slightly less than 50% health, and I just killed them, and I had to, like, just pause and, like, hide from the turret and the other monsters and just, like, okay, like, just, like, touch test without, like, actually pressing the buttons because you don't want to waste ammo or anything. Just, like, okay, triggers, that's quick attack, that's heavy attack. Oh, triangle. Oh, thank God. that's not an experience that you have in a game very often. I certainly don't, and, like, I wouldn't want to be always having that kind of experience, but it was really thrilling in its own kind of way. And generally, I haven't had too much trouble with the game. Like, I always make forward progress in any given, like, play session, so I don't feel that it's particularly unfair.
Yeah, we're gonna.
Yeah, well,
when we talk about Sekiro later, I'm gonna kind of contrast some of the feelings I've had with what you're describing. Admirax, what have you been playing?
So I picked up Sekiro and played about 20 minutes of it. I died 3 times in the tutorial level, so I think good things are on the way.
Awesome. That is pretty much my experience. Well, my experience was I was finding it super easy up until I hit the first mini boss, and then I died about 20 times.
I can't get the timing of the parry maneuver right.
Yeah.
And if you don't get the timing of the parry maneuver right, it's not good.
Oh yeah, the parries and staggers are really important in those games.
Yeah. So I'm looking forward to eventually throwing my controller out the window and hitting somebody on the sidewalk. Another game I picked up, I also have a backlog. I finally picked up Civ 6.
Oh, nice.
As I have a couple Good. Long plane rides coming up. So I wanted something for the Switch that would take up my time.
Oh, I didn't know it was on the Switch.
Yeah, it came out a couple
November.
Months ago.
Oh, nice.
Oh, November.
Are the expansions on it as well?
Not that I saw.
Oh, okay.
But they might be rolled into this version on the Switch, because there's a bunch of mechanics that are new that I don't recognize. So I'm still having a difficult time figuring all those out. And I know people were saying the new kind of visual style of the game is kind of off-putting. It makes it look a little bit like a mobile game. And I can kind of see where they're coming from. It's all very cartoony. Whereas I feel like 5 at the very least was a little more realistic looking. But I will say the graphics themselves are incredible. They're the detail that they can get into is blew me away, especially on the Switch.
Yeah, I really enjoyed 6 as an entry to the series that kind of tries to do things in cool different ways. The only districts I know, Drinking with Skeletons and Disagree, districts and me kind of just didn't get along. At a way that I really found enjoyable, but I don't know if it is on the Switch yet, but I really liked what some of the expansions did in terms of changing some of the way the gameplay and the game modes work. Rise and Fall, I think in particular, introduces some really cool mechanics where, like, if your Civ starts to fall behind, it's not so detrimental, and you can kind of have, like, there's like a catch-up mechanic where you're not always stuck, where you can't build new cities, you can't get tech, you know, and it's one of those games that kind of slowly spiral out of control, like we've all had in Civ. Rise and Fall introduces some mechanics to prevent that, and I think that was a really smart idea, because that's been a problem with Civ games for generations. So,
I'll have to pick up Rise and Fall, because Civ is a little like Monopoly, where you can kind of see pretty early on that you are in a losing spiral.
Yeah, and especially it makes, like, you can't expand. All the expansions mm-hmm. are kind of taken. All the strategic resources are kind of already claimed. You're stuck mm-hmm. just in this weird, like, you're having to trade for every little thing, and everybody's got you, you know, kind of, you know, up against it when it comes to what you can and can't get done in the trades and stuff. So, yeah, it's frustrating. Or then you get those weird warmonger penalties early on because you had to fight an expansion war right off the bat, and right. everybody hates you. You can't do right. anything about it.
Montezuma attacks me. And I'm asshole for it.
Yeah, I do like that. One of the things they introduced with 6.2 was that casus belli. You know, you can have a legit reason for declaring a war now, which I thought was very smart. And then you don't incur the kind of warmongering penalties you do if you just, you know, do the typical sneak attack with 10 catapults from the other side of their border. But yeah, I don't think the new one, I can't remember what it's called, the natural disasters one, I don't think that one was as impactful as Rise and Fall. But I really have lots of good thoughts about Civ 6 just and where Civ is going in general as a series.
Yeah, I think I'd just as soon skip the natural disaster one, as I don't need to be thinking about natural disasters that keep me up at night anymore than I already do.
Yeah, they're really only fun in the SimCity games where you would build a city and fuck up building it and then tear it to shreds with a flood or a
right.
monster
tsunami,
from outer space.
Tsunami.
What are the... They do have some, I don't know, I don't want to go too much back because I really don't like it as an expansion, but they do add some mechanics to it where, like, there's actually, like, a positive. So, like, let's say you build your city near a volcano. There's an odd that might, you know, obviously go off and wreck your city, but afterwards you get really fertile lands, you know, for generations to really, if you put farming improvements on it, it really increases the amount of yield that your farms will get. So they do try to do some stuff like that. Oh. Floodplains and things like that are really beneficial to build on. And there's a lot of wonders that can only be built on certain types of areas that are prone to flooding or prone to volcanoes or stuff like that. But it's not all completely as well thought out as that sounds. Because in practice, what it means is, like, you get a volcano every 5 years and you get, like, 2 months to enjoy, you know, the benefits. So, yeah, there's some of it that works into your favor and some of it that doesn't.
I remember in Zoo Tycoon, my brother and I used to just, we had the Marine Life expansion and we just make a really little, well, not really little, we'd make a small tank and we would just spam it with orcas and you'd get, like, hundreds of notifications that are just like, Orca 578 is unhappy. It's a good game. It's a really good game.
Zoo Tycoon was the fucking best, man.
That sounds like a nightmare. That's a nightmare scenario.
It sounds like Blackfish, if
that's,
I'm being honest.
I was going to say, it's like Blackfish Simulator.
Yeah, but
Zoo
Blackfish
Tycoon was
didn't
definitely...
have...
Zoo Tycoon is definitely one of those days games that
sorry.
I'm so sorry, Anmax.
Oh, no, that was me too. Zoo Tycoon is definitely one of those games where kind of near endgame when you would get bored, you would definitely just unleash hell. Just one fence segment and let it all go from there.
Watch the tigers eat the guests, that kind of thing.
Right, exactly. It was fun to do, like, penguins and gazelles, and then let the lions go. Am I remembering any? Maybe
the
I
lion, the lions would eat the penguins.
That's
so sad.
That's my memory.
Yeah,
I dreamed that. I haven't played it in maybe a couple decades.
The new Jurassic Park is basically designed around this whole premise. By the way, if you haven't played that Jurassic Park, what is that? Evolution?
Oh yeah, Jurassic Park Evolution.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's basically designed for you to let everything out at a regular interval to wipe out the park and start over.
I do.
We also made it so that zookeepers couldn't access poop. That was just the
That reminds me of when I played Roller Coaster Tycoon, I'd give all my bathrooms names like Fecal Fantasy and Poop Palace.
Like it's a ride.
I also charge 30 cents for every bathroom, so I'd make a profit.
You don't know what's inside there. It might be cool.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Well, if you... The really funny thing is if you do, like, a transparent view and you can see, quote unquote, inside the bathroom, and literally just guests walk in, stand in front of the wall for a little bit, and then walk out.
Oh, yeah. You don't want to be the animator who gets fired for putting in what goes on.
They could have done it like The Sims and, like, blurred it, but I think this was a few years before The Sims came out.
And one animator keeps volunteering for the bathroom animation.
Yeah. It's just like the only one person in the entire industry will touch it.
He's just really, really excited.
Gotta bring in Dan. He does the best bathrooms in the industry.
That's worked for so many studios. Anything else you want to say about Civ 6?
No, I'm sorry that the podcast went in a scatological direction.
Don't apologize. This is like the least scatological we've been in like the past 20 podcasts. So, Godzilla, what have you been playing?
Well, since 2014, Donkey Kong Country Tropical Freeze, and that is at this, like, it's not the only game I play, but it's really close to the only game I play.
That's so valid. I fucking love that game.
Yeah, so basically I played the crap out of it in 2014, 2015 on Wii U, and then I didn't get bored of it, but I kind of stopped playing most games, or at least most games that are like the $80 Canadian 40-hour things. I just kind of got away from that, and then it came out for Switch, and I was like, okay, I'm going to play this again, and then I started playing it, and I was like, okay, this is just like obviously exactly the same as I remember. Like, yes, there's funky mode, but I haven't touched that yet. There is a reason I'm going to get into it, but I'll get to that in a second. But then I was just kind of like, okay, in the time between I last played this, I've gotten really into speedruns, and this is the one game I think I could feasibly speedrun. So after I had gotten back into it and gotten a feel for it, I was like, okay, I'm going to watch some of the tutorials. I'm going to kind of read some stuff in the community, and it is maddening, because this game that I am in theory very good at, because it's the only thing I've been playing for about 6 years, is I have to relearn it from the ground up. It's completely different. And it's a cool thing. It's fun. But it's kind of, and when it works, it's amazing. Because, like, there was this, I don't know the name of the boss. It's probably, like, King Hootie. But there's, like, a big owl. And in like, a casual run, it's a nightmare. Because it's, like, three
faces. Fuck that owl.
Yeah, here's the thing about that. Here's the thing about that owl. So it's three phases, and each phase is three hits. And what I have learned, and what I have learned to do, and I'm really proud of myself, because this is the only part of this speedrun I can do. I will say that owl is probably the best platformer boss ever conceived, because you can, yes, it can take like 6 minutes, or it can take two. And the reason it can take two is on each phase, you can do all three hits basically at once. Like, it's crazy. It's so cool. And that's the only thing I figured out in it. Otherwise, the whole run is impossible. But I'm really proud of myself for getting that owl. And then the funky mode thing, that's become kind of the more fashionable run to do, because not because it's easier, but because Funky's movement is just a little faster. Like, he's got he's faster, but it's kind of faster at cost. And the cost is he's got an additional jump, but if you hold that additional jump too long, he's got this abysmal hover that, like, makes it so you don't fall off the edge, but you lose like 3 seconds if you accidentally start that animation. So it's like, shit. Oh,
so it's actually hard mode for speedrun.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's like, it's really cool. And so I haven't done funky mode yet, because I'm like, I just got a handle on using cranky. I'm going to stick with... And also, Funky's noises are not as funny.
Isn't cranky like arthritic? How does he jump everywhere?
If you've ever played the DuckTales NES game, which I haven't, but I'm surrounded by older people, so I've heard about it.
Ouch.
His cane is a pogo stick.
Okay, yeah. So he's like Commander Keen, but older?
I know nothing about Commander Keen.
I can't remember.
Okay, now you're making me feel old, and I'm not that old.
Time with just references.
So which is your favorite sidekick to use?
It's casually I like Dixie, but I have to move to Cranky, which is a nightmare, because Cranky casually is the worst one, because he has that, it's basically a dive bomb, and it's the thing about that dive bomb is it gets momentum higher, it is immune to all spiky enemies, so like if you're trying to do things fast, you have to learn Cranky. And so I'm sort of learning Cranky, And I think he is also the funniest because he's got this like horrible screech anytime he does it. But yeah. And the noises in this game are a big deal to me. I really like them. I like Donkey Kong screaming like hoo hoo every time.
Donkey Kong sounds like Fred Flintstone, and it's extremely charming.
It's great.
But you know, I'm as a deeply casual Donkey Kong fan, I'll just stick with Dixie because she's objectively the best.
Yeah. No, and it's weird, like, so you have to kind of learn Cranky, and I can kind of get a handle, and you don't use Rambi anymore, and that has been a hurdle because there's like Mountain Mania has that volcano segment, and it's just easier if you can just bang the R button and just scoot through it. But you can't. Rambi's jump speed it's the same as the funky thing. You lose a ton of time on it, and yeah, no, but that's the main thing I've been doing. And then I also like played a handful of other games, but I just keep coming back to that. And it's just like, whatever, it's got an ape in it. Like, I'm going to play this.
Yeah, no, it's a very well-designed, very replayable game for sure. I still haven't beaten the final boss. But
the final boss sucks. I got to watch some stuff on him because in my current file where I'm just kind of practicing early levels, I haven't even finished it. Like, I have 100% of the game, but that was in 2015. I have one more thing to add, and I may have just lost it, so I may not have one more thing to add. Oh, yeah, if you're interested at all in speedruns of this game, the main level I recommend checking out is Bramble Scramble, because Bramble Scramble is the one where the level kind of appears underneath you as you do it. Like, basically, like, plants will grow kind of right in front of you as you approximate them. And in a speed run, you're doing the level faster than the level can generate. So, like, it's just this level that kind of conjures itself beneath Donkey Kong, slightly behind him, pretty much. It's so cool.
You have to know in advance where the plant's going to be.
Yeah, and I think that's going to be, once I really get a handle on this owl boss, that's going to be the next one that I kind of learn, because I think it will be basically the coolest party trick of the bunch. But yeah, no, it's a nutso game. Like, it's great casually, and then speedrunning, though, it's just been weird, something that I'm so familiar with becoming almost entirely unfamiliar with it again, because it's just really different. It's crazy.
So are you planning to do, like, is the goal to eventually do a full game speedrun at some point?
My goal is to finish the entire game basically in an evening. I don't think I'll ever get, like, generally, if you're good at it, you're floating around 90 minutes. If I can get 3.5 hours, I'm happy with that. Like, I'm so new to this that I don't even know the optimal route yet. Like, it's okay. Just kind of like, I'm just learning levels kind of one at a time. Where it's like, oh, I think this level's interesting, or oh, I think I know how to do this one. What's good about it too is it's the game is like recent enough that it's not super duper buggy. Like, you're not exploiting a lot of kind of weirder stuff. It's mostly just being good at a platformer. Okay. It is a hard platformer to begin with, and
I've heard it's brutal, or it can be. So I look forward to seeing you at AGDQ 2023.
Yeah, no, let's bump it to 2028. And we might have some.
All right. So that's what we've been playing. We've also been on the internet memeing, of course. And Avarax told me before we record this podcast that she was fed up with the "we live in a society" meme, and I'm also fed up with this meme, so I'm curious why Amarax is fed up with it as well.
So I'll start by saying I was a big Seinfeld fan. So a Seinfeld quote was starting to become a meme. I was kind of like, oh, okay, I can get on board with that, maybe.
Wait, it's a Seinfeld quote? I know nothing
it's from the Chinese restaurant episode. The entire episode is just them waiting for a table at a Chinese restaurant. And as you can well imagine, it all starts to go to hell. And George, I don't remember what he gets fed up with, but George finally gets fed up. I think he's trying to use a payphone. And somebody keeps bogarting the payphone, and he finally breaks down and says, you know, we live in a society. There's supposed to be rules. And so kind of taking...
I understand it now.
I still
I'm sure that
I don't understand why this is paired with the Joker.
I'm sure that meme was really even more baffling, not knowing what the context was. But to take that out of context and to just put it with the Joker for some reason, and then I was already sick of the Joker being used as a meme. I thought it was kind of lazy. And then my, and I hope this isn't getting too serious for this podcast, but
my
concern with this, like, Gamers Rise Up kind of stuff is that, as we've seen with the rise of white nationalism across the planet, memes turn from ironic into serious. So
yeah,
I really am very concerned about people's ability, especially, you know, people on the internet, their ability to kind of separate Gamers Rise Up being a joke from being reality. And I know it starts...
Even the Joker himself being used as this weird pop culture anti-authority symbol. We shouldn't forget that there was literally a mass shooter dressed as the Joker less than a decade ago.
Oh, God.
Y'all remember that, Aurora?
I forgot about that.
Yeah, the one in...
Colorado.
Yeah. Was he dressed as the Joker?
Yeah.
I think he had dyed hair. I don't necessarily think he was.
Yeah, I think he was in full Joker garb, but he was referencing the Joker.
And it was at a Batman screening.
It was at a Batman screening, I knew that, but oh God, that's gross.
Wait, look. Yeah. I'm thinking of a different Joker related killing then. Because there was also the one at the preschool or something in.
Oh, Jesus.
Right after. Yeah, anyway, we don't need to get into that.
Well, that kind of underlines my point, though.
as someone who probably 3 or 4 months ago actually enjoyed the, I'm not going to lie, I enjoyed the Gamers Rise Up stuff in an ironic way, because that's how it originally really was presented, you know? I totally agree with you that now people have really lost what made it ironic and funny, and now it's just, I want to be casually racist, or I want to be casually homophobic instead. And it's really ruined my enjoyment of it. Because when it came out, it was like, you know, we live in a society where gamers aren't allowed to say the N-word over Xbox Live. But, you know.
That's funny.
Right. And I thought that was funny, because it was like, you know, they're complaining about something that is definitely not what society is about. And, you know, complaining from a very, like, privileged perspective about something that's very ridiculous. But it's kind of turned on its head now, to where, like, I think, like you're saying, people are actually taking it seriously. And it ruins the fun, because now instead of laughing at the joke, I have to look at it and be like, wait, is this guy kind of being serious about this? Yeah. Or is this just something like, you know, he's taking it in a whole meta direction, which memes can sometimes do and still be funny, but it ruins your enjoyment of it. If you're, like you're saying, if you're linking it to a lot more serious stuff, it's not as fun anymore.
See, I didn't even really understand what the meme was. I just saw it popping up every now and then in places, and then people laughing about it. And I don't know whether the people who are laughing at it are
well, when it first started, I think it came from the sense of gamer entitlement, which was really a big thing around that time, right? It was, you know...
It hasn't stopped being a big thing.
Yeah.
Right.
We're going to get a little bit into that in a little bit.
I think that was a part of that was funny to me, because I was sick of people saying, you know, basically make the game the way I want, and I don't want to have... I think where it came from, honestly, was Battlefield 5. You remember the issue with having a female protagonist in certain World War II settings, people didn't like that, you know? So I feel like that was this meme was kind of a backlash to that, which I appreciated, because it was like, well, you know, you can't have a female protagonist in a World War II game, because lots of people on Reddit went and had these really hyperbolic reactions about it. Like, you're spitting on the graves of a million dead men. You know what I mean? Like, just like stuff like that. And it was really kind of like overwrought stuff. That I thought that meme kind of, you know, took the piss from, you know, to steal a phrase from, I don't know, Australians, I guess, said that. But, yeah. you know, it took a lot of, you know, the stuff out of it to say, oh, yeah, we live in this society where, you know, you spit on the graves of a million men to, you know, like, but it, I thought it was funny because it was obviously so hyperbolic. But now, like I think everybody's saying, it's not funny anymore. It's just kind of sad more than anything.
Yeah, how did it get paired with the Joker?
I think what happened was there was an early there was like one of those Twitter sites that just reposts weird things, right? And they were one of the ones who posted the original Gamers Rise up. I think there was actually a Twitter account called something like that, like Gamers Rising or something like that. And it basically was one of those Twitter accounts that fed on gamer rage and gamer entitlement, right? And they used a lot of those Joker memes. And they also sometimes would forget to put bottom text in there, which is, you know, in the shitty memes.
So it's like no caption.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, they would have the whole part up top, and they would forget to put bottom text. You know, on a lot of those meme generators, you have to put bottom text. So they would just leave bottom text. But there was a lot of those, you know how there's those Twitter pages that kind of just thrive on getting shared by people, you know, for different reasons.
Thrive on virality.
Yeah, there was one of those sites that basically was doing exactly that, and it was a very Gamers Rise Up, Game Revolution type stuff like that, where people were like, what are we revolting against? You know, like, now's the best time to play video games basically ever. But yeah, I think that's kind of where a lot of that came from, the Joker, and more of it as like a you know how the Joker was being used back then with Harley, and he was so crazy and everything. It was more of the Suicide Squad Joker than the Heath Ledger Joker, but I think I've kind of seen them being interchangeable lately in those memes. But like I said, I mean, I think if you kind of look at the history of it, it comes from a perspective of, you know, making fun of the entitlement and the, you know, the poor gamer that, you know, feels disenfranchised, but actually is probably one of the most privileged people on the planet.
It's like PC Master Race, which started out as a joke. And now, like, PC
people unironically
gamers,
call themselves that. Yeah.
Yeah, they call themselves PC Master Race. Like, you do realize that where Master Race comes from, right?
I think that's a really good parallel, because, like, at first that might have been something that I would have said to a friend unironically, you know? Like, hey, man, what are you getting Destiny on? Oh, yeah, PC Master Race. You know, that might have been something I would have said, but now I'm like, oh, my God, that's cringy as fuck to say that, you know? Like, because it's not... What you're saying is really inappropriate for the context, number one, but number two, it just sounds like you're gloating over owning something, which is a really stupid thing to do in the first place, you know. So
that's where a lot of that stems from, is not finding an identity outside of being a gamer.
Yeah, and me and Merv have talked about that a lot. I don't think I've ever unironically called myself a gamer. I mean, you know, we do a lot of stuff in our Discord and stuff, you know, and it's like, how you doing, gamer, you know, but it's very detached, you know. But I don't think I'd ever unironically call myself a gamer, because of all the negative connotations it carries right now. It just, I mean, yeah, you might as well be calling yourself racist, right?
It's weird it's just weird when corporations lean, just like, hey, gamers, what's up? It's like, don't do that. Like,
I'm not your friend.
Not your friend, and I don't want to be identified by that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Girl gamer thing so funny with the e-sport dress?
Mm-hmm.
Girl gamers, here's a bunch of nail painting emojis.
Yeah,
that's so
poor girl gamers. That's the only thing I have to say.
Like, I'm fine with gamer as a label, and I do use it unironically just because I think it's a convenient shorthand. But like, my feelings on this are, you know, I'm a gamer in the context of playing video games, but it's not the thing that defines my life, right? I find it weird than people like define them like. It's the central thing in their lives.
Right. Like, you would never define yourself as a moviegoer, right? You would never be a TV watcher. Oh, yeah. No. He's such a
TV
watcher.
Yeah, you could be like, a movie buff. Like,
I know
a
million people that call themselves cinephiles.
Well, I think that's what you need for games, then. You need, like, I watch movies on Netflix versus I live at the movie theater. And I think that you could probably look for something for gamers. I'm a game player versus a gamer. You know what I mean? Like,
I don't think the making it classier would help the larger problem, because I hate all of those guys too.
I don't mind people like calling themselves gamers or identifying themselves by what they do. It's the centrality of it to their lives, to the point that they want to like gatekeep.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, you can put lots of things. Like, it's probably good, you know, to love your children, to be a great parent. But also, if you're Jaden's mommy, I probably don't want to talk to you. You know, like, I'm sorry, I just don't.
Like, Jaden, like, Jaden Smith's mommy?
No. If you introduce, I don't know.
I think we all want to watch.
No, I get what you're saying, Kappa. If it's your Instagram handle is Jaden's mom.
Yeah. Exactly.
You know exactly who that person is right away by the way they describe themselves.
Or you meet them at karate class and they shake your hand. They don't tell you their name. They say they're, you know, I'm Bobby's daddy. Oh, come on, man. We're adults here. Let's use real names. You know, like it's when you put something like anything central to your life, I feel like you're kind of reaching for an identity. I think Amarak said that earlier, but I think once you start reaching for that identity, it just looks weird. And especially if that identity you're trying to build is around being a gamer, I don't know if I can get behind that. And I probably play more video games than almost anybody. So
I just noticed I'm wearing a Donkey Kong shirt while I'm talking about Donkey Kong. So like
we know what you do.
I'm going to keep throwing stones, but I'm on the same page as I think everybody here though. Like it's kind of,
yeah,
I don't know. The Jane's mom is a really good point of reference.
Yeah, that's fair.
Fair comparison. The one that I always think of, I don't want to belabor this point though, is like, would anyone, literally anyone, be comfortable calling themselves a consumer as a central identity? Like, as a...
Right.
You know. I'm a consumer. I like buying things.
I've probably done that on the
like,
avocado.
Those are people who, like, post unboxing videos on YouTube.
There are 100% people who do that. I had a college roommate who was the most, like, overtly, like, capitalist-identified person I've ever met. But you get what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. I totally get it. My concern with this whole thing, and I'm not like trying to push back against the general sentiment, but my concern with sort of the way the discourse around the whole gamer label has proceeded is, if people don't want to self-identify as gamers or do whatever, it's more like I don't want the hobby itself to be associated with the worst elements of the community. So I'll push back against.
Yeah, I don't think
I'll push
it
back
is.
Against. Like, I'd rather people just saying, "Oh, I'm a gamer," is just a normal thing to just say in an appropriate context. Like, if we're talking about hobbies, like say, "Oh yeah, I'm a gamer," that's fine. But yeah. if somebody walks up to you and say, and like you introduce yourself as a gamer, that's very different.
Yeah, right. I think where it's hardest is probably for certain games, honestly. Like, if you say, I play a ton of Call of Duty, already what's popping in your mind, right? Or I play a bunch of Madden. You know, there's like, definitely some stereotypes within the gaming
world. I want to dismantle those stereotypes.
World. Yeah, yeah, I get that. But, I mean, I think that within games that can be played, I think there's a lot of ups and downs type games. But I feel like, if anything right now, gaming as a hobby is way more normal than you might imagine. I mean, when I was in the Army 10 years ago, I had a lieutenant colonel who all he did all day was play Battlefield. You know what I mean? And like, this guy's like, you know, he's up there and he's an old timer and yeah, he knows what he's doing. And if you were in good with him, he'd say, "Hey man, I need a tank driver." And you go drive around with your battalion commander in a video game. So it's normalized. I mean, it's just one of those things where I think that part of it's always been marketing. Ever since I can think of playing video games, the marketing that has always been like, "Mom, don't knock on my door, I'm busy fragging noobs," that kind of shit, like, you know, like it's always
game
annoying. Exactly. Yeah, like even when I was like 12 or 13, like the target market for that shit, I was like, "Oh, this is awful."
Or like, it's all like the like I don't care for the whole like scantily clad like big boob fantasy lady aesthetic that he used to try to sell like teenage boys on video games. I don't care for that at all.
Yeah.
And like the whole, you know, gamer fuel, get good, Doritos and Dew kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I'm not really into that whole way of selling things to me. And I know I'm a broken record when I say this, but I think games matured way faster than the marketing for them.
Yes, 100%.
And yeah, it's strange sometimes to see like that marketing out of step with the actual product.
And I think that marketing kind of bred some of the problem that we're seeing today is that people growing up seeing all those advertisements are now thinking that that's how it's still supposed to be. Like it's still supposed to be scantily clad women and
yeah,
such a weird
super aggro playing.
the young guys who embrace that and they never learned that maybe they shouldn't embrace it.
Right. It's so weird though, because the actual games they're playing embrace it a lot less than they think it does. It's such a weird thing to be defending.
You know what I'd like to go back to in terms of advertising? Does anybody remember? And this, I'll try not to derail with this too much, but I love it. There was a Star Fox VHS ad that came with Nintendo Power, and it is the apex of game advertising for me, where it's like a guy wearing a Sony sweater and a guy wearing a Sega sweater, and they kidnap the Nintendo guy who's just parachuted into Nintendo. And they bring him in, and they're like torturing a plushie of Mario, and he's like, "All right, I'll tell you, we got Star Fox 64 coming out." And they're like, "Star Fox 64? And it's just like, it's amazing. It's so good. And it's like a 10-minute ad that has nothing to do with Star Fox and everything to do with this drama between these three guys. And it's like, that's what I want. That's what I want to go back to.
I think the console wars, I it's dumb to call them a war, first of all, but I think the console wars were such a bad time for marketing and identifying gamers. And it became this thing where I'm a Nintendo gamer. Okay, so what's a Nintendo gamer, right? I'm a Sony gamer, okay? They had to kind of define themselves, right? So in a weird way, all of them basically define themselves in certain ways.
Sega does what Nintendo don't.
Right.
They define themselves by Nintendo.
And I think that kind of has always stuck around. You know, I mean, I think even to this day, when I talk to people about, you know, what I'm going to play on or whatever, it's like, "Oh, man, you're going to play on the Switch. That's all kiddie stuff." I'm like, it is literally not.
I
have Bayonetta for it. That's not a kiddie game.
lives in this world.
Doom and Wolfenstein and, yeah.
Yeah, and the new Travis Touchdown game. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I don't know. These issues are kind of all entangled with quote-unquote gamer identity and in these weird ways that are really hard to talk about. And we're going to tangle them a little bit further because we're going to talk about difficulty and challenge in games, which is something that a lot of people have sort of rallied around recently in the wake of Sekiro Shadows Die Twice coming out, which is, and I can say it's from experience, as we were mentioning earlier, a really difficult video game. So there's been lots of passionate discussion about it. Some people think the difficulty is part of the game's artistic vision. Other people think, you know, if you made it easier, it'd be more accessible. And, you know, those are sort of the two camps. And I should point out these opinions aren't mutually exclusive. You can think that something's part of a game's artistic vision, but also isn't accessible. So what I'd like to do is sort of talk about, you know, difficulty in specifically Sekiro, and how the gaming communities reacted to it, and then kind of use that as a springboard to talk a little bit more about challenge and difficulty in video games. So just my own experience with Sekiro, it's really hard. not always in a good way, which I'll get to. So what I find with a lot of games that are difficult is that sometimes they're really hard to critique because it's very hard to distinguish between I'm bad at this game and this is a bad game. And especially in the case of Sekiro, which has a lot of good elements, it's extremely hard to distinguish between the two. But I will say this. There are a lot of very difficult games that haven't sparked this conversation. Like, Just to give some examples, like N, that like ninja platformer, N and its sequels N plus and N plus plus haven't sparked a major conversation about difficulty. Super Meat Boy hasn't. Binding of Isaac hasn't. Super Hexagon hasn't.
I'd like to address that for a second, if that's okay.
Yeah.
I acknowledge that. Yeah, the size of the discourse around those games is not comparable in terms of like talking about their difficulty, but I deny the fact that there hasn't been any discourse about their difficulty, because let me tell you, Super Meat Boy, I literally never got past the first screen.
I shouldn't say there hasn't been any discourse, but like
I had a little bit more. I'm sorry.
Sure.
I'll try to be fast. I acknowledge I tried that when I was in high school. I've gotten a lot better at games since then. Like I doubt, you know, I'd be doing as well in Bloodborne as I am if I tried it when I was 16. So, you know, I'd probably be doing better in Super Meat Boy right now. But generally, that kind of like 2D,
platformers.
Yeah, the massacre stuff, stuff that is, you know, is consciously like aping NES stuff, at least to varying extent, NES and SNES. Like, I find that a lot more challenging by and large than like 3D rendered stuff.
Yeah, that's fair.
Like that's just
like, I don't mean to say that they're like not difficult. I think my point is that they haven't, compared to their, just even controlling for their popularity, I don't think they've inspired the same level and passion of discourse.
I get that. I just wanted to express a personal perspective on that, which is that, like,
oh yeah, yeah. I haven't even played Super Meat Boy, so yeah, I'll
really
defer you on
that. Seems like such a Merv game to me.
I mean, I've played a lot of N. N was my jam back in the day, and that game is tough as balls, but I love it. So, you know, there are lots of difficult games that don't really inspire the same level of passionate discourse. And I'm wondering, when it comes to From Software's output, especially Sekiro, is this because the game is difficult or because the difficulty isn't well designed?
Well, if I can, I'm coming at it from a perspective of somebody who doesn't really enjoy the games, honestly. I think the reason is because the difficulty is the game. That's what I think it comes down to. I think if you strip that game of, you know, some of what people think about it is so hard, the game's not fun anymore. That's why there's not an easy mode, because there's nothing else there. There's no real, you know what I mean?
I don't agree at all.
I haven't played the other Souls games.
Yeah.
I would dispute that with Sekiro.
I haven't played Sekiro, but I'm saying from Dragon Souls 1, 2, maybe not Bloodborne. Bloodborne's got a little bit more going on, but at least the core Souls games, I don't feel like there's enough game there past difficulty that makes the game any fun. Nobody talks about, hey, did you get this lore or this, or, you know, did you get this from the store? It's, hey, did you beat this boss? What did you do? How did you beat it? What build did you use?
A shit ton of people talk about the lore in the Souls games.
There's a whole YouTube
community centered around it.
It's one of those things that's kind of like buried, though. But yeah, I would say, lots of people do talk about the lore, but it's for whatever reason in discourse, it's kind of secondary to how people talk about, like, playing the game, and like the difficulty in the combat. But kind, yeah, there definitely are a lot of people talking about lore and other parts of it. When a game gets that popular, I think you're always going to get people approaching it from different angles.
Mm-hmm. Kind of adjacent to this, before we get too far from this, I just want to say, related to the idea of people feeling like they're missing out on something, there were like 3,000 think pieces about Cuphead that were kind of like, oh, this is a beautiful game, but mm-hmm. I can't play it. And it's just kind of like, and that kind of feels like it's comparable, I guess, like in terms of, there's kind of a similar vibe where, I don't know, people were really upset that they couldn't see more of Cuphead when it's all on YouTube. And it just was, yeah.
There was legitimate accessibility criticisms of Cuphead.
Yeah.
That
I don't think we ever fully engaged with Cuphead, I think, was the way the store worked. I don't know if they ever fixed that or patched that or what, but I didn't like having to buy through everything in order to get to the stuff that obviously made certain things easier. Did you guys play Cuphead?
I haven't actually played it.
I haven't played it because, sorry.
I've played it.
I'm going to play it when it's on Switch, and even if it had come out on Switch like last year or the year before that, like I wouldn't have said that I was going to try it before, like, I had gotten the practice with games to be able to say, like, yeah, no, I know my skills are a little better than they used to be, so I'm willing to try it now.
Well, Admirax, you know what I mean, though, about the way the store worked, right? Where you had to grind coins, and in order to grind coins, you had to buy out the store for certain other things to appear in the store, even though some of them were like, okay, this is not going to be at all useful for the boss I'm struggling with, but I've got to go find out where I can go grind coins, which were, I think they were a finite resource, right?
They are, yeah.
So, I mean, you're kind of in this weird grind in a single player game when you obviously know, okay, this is not what I need, but it's what I need to buy in order to get what I need. I really didn't like that mechanic of it. But past that, I felt Cuphead is a very good example of difficulty because it teaches you, it trains you, and it doesn't hold your hand about it, but it takes you along the pathway of, okay, this is the skill you need to use and you need to learn in kind of a smart way. And once you do what the game wants you to do, it's one of those games where you feel yourself getting better. And to me, that's the hallmark of kind of doing difficulty right.
Okay. To me, I think Cuphead, I would get so mad, especially that damn dragon. I would get so upset.
The plane, and... but, yeah.
The which one?
The first plane you fight. I can't remember what the sisters that turn into cyclones and planes.
Oh,
and...
yeah, yeah. For some reason, I love the plane levels. Those I find very fun, but the dragon really knocked me on my ass. But for some reason, Cuphead, when you finally beat one of those bosses, it is like the wave of relief and satisfaction that you get is indescribable. it makes you want to keep playing.
Yep. And see what the next thing is and learn the next thing. I think Cuphead, when I think about difficult games, it was definitely before, you know, outside of the Souls arenas, it was what people considered a difficult game kind of in the last, you know, 2 or 3 years. And the experience I had with Cuphead was so different than I think what a lot of people were saying theirs was, because while it was difficult, the modes were so different. We're like, oh man, I'm really good at the platforming one. I'm not so good at the boss rush and I'm off of the plane ones. Where I felt like, okay, the game still moved along pretty in a fun way because it wasn't the same gameplay over and over again. But I think
one of the good designs about that game is that if you were having trouble with a boss, there's a lot of other bosses on that island that you can go and try and see if you get better at that.
And the other thing I liked about it as well is, let's say you're playing and you're struggling with this one character, you can always come back to it. And the load times are so fast that it doesn't feel like you've lost a ton of time before, like, you're right back into, you know, Let's Rumble or whatever. I can't remember the saying.
That's key. Wallop.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even from like, a psychological perspective, to be able to just jump right back in. And this is what MasterCore platformers have done that makes them a little more, I shouldn't say accessible, but a little less frustrating, is because you can just restart right away.
Well, when you see speedrunners, I mean, what they're usually doing on a lot of the older games is they're running on emulators, right? And they're saving states at hard parts, and then they're just hitting a button and reloading the state, right? And, I mean, Cuphead isn't that fast, but it approximates that kind of like, okay, well, you know what? Hit this button. You're back in the fight. You don't have to sit there and you know, try to get a boss fight done, especially if you're trying to do something like get the Ace achievements or things like that. The game is very well technically done, and I think that helps it a lot with the difficulty being, to me at least, a little more easy to deal with. And I've heard, Merv, you said that Sekiro is kind of the opposite.
Yeah, so I guess in the case of Cuphead, just its design being so easy to try and try again, I was kind of, for the last couple of weeks, I've been under the impression that people have been like a little bit entitled, as we were saying earlier, to say that I should be able to play this game. It shouldn't be as hard as it is. But I'm starting to kind of go back on that thought, and maybe a game difficulty like Cuphead, I think, being more accessible, that it is easy to try again and learn the patterns. I assume that doesn't apply to Sekiro so much.
So Sekiro is weird in that it's so strange, because I've never played Cuphead, but a lot of the things you're describing about Cuphead, like, you know, being able to go and do something else if you're getting frustrated with one thing, having to learn patterns and recognize them, that's all part of Sekiro.
Those all sound extremely familiar to me as someone just starting Bloodborne as well. They sound extremely familiar to me.
So these are all things that are part of Sekiro, but for me, and I'm speaking me personally, for a lot of other people it has worked. For me personally, it just doesn't work so well in Sekiro. And I'm trying to figure out exactly what the point of departure is. Part of it is that if you die, the penalties are really, really huge. Like, you lose half your money, half your XP, and those are not insignificant penalties in some cases. The other, and then on top of that, if you die too much, then quest lines get turned off, and you have to go through a whole bunch of tedium to turn them back on. It's not fun.
And there is even a cap, like you can resurrect without losing your money and shit, but there is a cap on the number of resurrections you can do. And if I recall correctly, you know, the resurrections are tied to the dragon rot thing. And there's a, from my understanding, it's not that hard to stop the dragon rot, but it's still like a cost.
It's actually, so I looked it up and I'm not going to spoil it. It's easy to stop it initially, but there is a problem later in the game. Like if you die too much,
that reminds me kind of, you know, we talked about Dishonored a fair share, and I've always said the one thing I always hated was the high chaos, right? For playing the game how you want to play. Mechanics like that just push me away from games. Not being able to experience the whole story because of mechanics like that. I don't know how to describe it. What was the game in the mall, the zombie game? Really
Dead
generic.
Dead Rising?
Yeah. You know how, like, in the first one, like, there was the time limit, and there was, like, certain people that you had to meet at certain times, and...
I never did that. I just ordered things with guitars.
I love that system.
it's boing. Yeah, I would just, like, dress up like Mega Man and want to go blast zombies, but it's like, okay, if you want to do this quest at 12:30, you've got to do this, you got to do this. It just kind of pushes me away from the game.
I love that kind of shit. I like specifically... I like that, like, kind of, like, time limit and structure kind of thing. I think that's so exciting and so fun.
It feels like work. It feels like setting, like, a schedule and, like, I don't know. I didn't enjoy that part of it, but...
It feels like I'm in school again.
Yeah, when game mechanics...
Yeah, I like school.
I don't know.
I love school. Don't get me wrong. I just don't want to do school while I'm playing games.
I mean, I guess. I don't know.
I love...
But that's just me. We can talk about my love of school later.
Sure.
On the school podcast.
On the
Persona podcast.
I'm still in college. I could do a school podcast.
Will we be in character? Because I like that.
Oh, God.
I spent 10 years in post-secondary education. Like, I've done a lot of school.
That's the school of life. I don't know what you guys are talking
about. Yeah, I'm never going to leave.
School of hard knocks.
Yeah. No, but like to the broader point of like these things kind of pushing you away. On top of that, it's not just the fact that the game punishes you. It's also sort of the way it punishes you and the way checkpoints work. Like say you die at a boss fight, then you get pushed back to the most recent checkpoint, but then there's a whole bunch of stuff you need to do before you reach the boss. So you just have to redo it over and over and over again. And that's just tedious. Like, and eventually get so good at getting, like, identifying the patterns of enemies you need to kill before you reach the boss. So you end up, like, running, you end up, like, effectively speed running the part of the game before the boss.
Yeah,
over and over
fun.
And over again.
Sounds like you need to get good to me, Mer.
It's just, but I find that tedious.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to keep doing it over and over and over again. Because at a certain point, I've already gotten good at it. Like, you know, if I can speed run through this part in, like, 2 minutes, where before it took me 30 because I was going super carefully and stealthing through it instead of just, like, sprinting past enemies, you know, it takes the fun out of the game.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are other things that are not great about it. There's certain mechanical things, like really nitty gritty mechanical things that don't work very well. Like you mentioned, being able to resurrect, and resurrections are limited. When you resurrect, you lose targeting. So, if you're
like
no longer
targeting,
yeah, you use your lock on, which is bad because then the only way you can lock on is if you're focusing direct, if you're facing an enemy directly, if your camera's right in the direction of the enemy. So And a lot of the bosses, like, run around like crazy. So when you resurrect, first it spins your camera around, so you don't know where you're going to be when you resurrect. And then you have to rotate your camera around while the boss is attacking you, in order to lock on again. It's stupid. They should just keep the lock on when you resurrect. I don't know. I find it just. So you can resurrect at half health and just get, like, destroyed immediately because you couldn't rotate your camera fast enough. It's just physically impossible because
And
the
then you
camera.
lose the souls or whatever, I'm guessing, the equivalent of.
Yeah, it's just. It's a really dumb thing that has a really easy fix that just makes it needlessly difficult. And there are lots of things like that in the game where they're just things that are needlessly dumb or difficult that don't really add anything to the game. And there are parts of the game that I think are difficult but really cool. One-on-one, if you're battling somebody one-on-one, it's super, super easy. But if you're battling people like two-on-one, that's when things get challenging and interesting, and then you have to kind of jump around and dodge and things like that.
Playing groups is really fun.
Yeah, so that's when you get this sort of nice mix between challenge and difficulty. But otherwise, there are parts of the game that are just stupidly easy. Like you can just stealth past enemies like that. I'm snapping my fingers. You can't see me doing that, but imagine me snapping my fingers.
I could hurt you. I heard
Yeah, it's so easy to just stealth past enemies and kill them from stealth. It's completely broken in that regard. But then the bosses are just such a step up in difficulty that the difficulty curve makes no sense. But of course, I'm sure somebody listening to this podcast could be like, "Get good, scrub. I'm sick of video games."
I wanted to talk about the get good phenomenon, and I mean, I'm sure you guys can think of lots of places where it did or didn't start. But do you guys remember the Ninja Gaiden Xbox, game? And they instituted an easy mode where, yeah, I think you had to wear like a pink ribbon and stuff like that. I feel like at that point we were kind of shaming people instead of letting them enjoy the game how they wanted to, and it kind of took a turn. And I think that I think the get good phenomena is really awful and goes back to gamers poning noobs, type that I never really liked.
There's also this culture that's very, very particular, like related to all of this, which is like basically r romanticizing an earlier era of gaming, which is, yeah, it's romanticized on the basis of like its intense challenge. And so much of that intense challenge was not even by conscious design, but just technical limitations and other things to keep you, pumping quarters into the same machine over and over.
Space Invaders gets harder because it was they programmed it weird. Like they get faster because there's less of them. Like it wasn't deliberate. It's just kind of like, which, and that's a cool thing. That's a good one. But I know what you're actually saying. I just think the Space Invaders thing is
And,
funny.
like, for example, wasn't the Battletoads
Fucking
infamous?
Battletoads.
Wasn't that a glitch as well? Like, you were supposed to get more of a warning with the little things that came up that you had to jump on the bike. I remember that being something like, yeah, this wasn't supposed to be this hard, but it ended up this way and we left it in.
So, and part of that romanticization ties into what we were talking about earlier, in that people are identifying or making their ability to play these games part of their identity in this very toxic way. And because it's part of their identity, they see other people muscling in on that as a threat. And to me, that's just so weird because if I like something, I want as many people as possible to be able to experience it. Like, I'm obnoxious about it. I'm an evangelist. Like, that's one of my faults, for sure. So if I really like something, I don't care if they play it on friggin' baby mode. I just want them to play it.
Yeah, there's gaming is not a finite resource.
Right. And you know those like Facebook shirts that are like never mess with a firefighter born in July, whenever
What does that mean?
I think it's
It means exactly what it
literal.
says.
No, I don't get it.
If you ever want to be a millionaire, make a shirt that's like never mess with a Souls gamer born in whatever month, be a millionaire. Because like at least on the internet, I think they've kind of like had this whole like mentality, and not all, trust me,
Why
especially
does
not
the
the ones
month
that I
matter?
hang out with. But I feel like, you know, it's kind of like been one of those things where it's like, oh man, I'm really having difficulty in pick a game, right? I'm having hard reading cover two in Madden 19. Well, you know, I'm sorry to hear that you're having that trouble. But let me tell you about my boss fight in Dark Souls 2. You know what I mean? Like, totally unrelated. I think there's a tendency to like equate all difficulties to all difficulties, right? And that's not necessarily what most people are looking to do when they're talking about difficulty in a game. They're not trying to one up each other. But I do think there is a little bit, and it's not just Souls gamers. I mean, there's plenty of, you know, like I talked a little bit about in one of the other podcasts. You guys remember I Want to Be the Guy?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like games like that where it's just like, you know, you almost play it, you know, just to say that you beat it and to brag to other people that you did, but the game itself is ho-hum, you know. But
I just want to say, and inversely to this, there's almost like I used to know a couple of people that would use Kirby as shorthand, and it's kind of like, yeah, but Kirby's delightful,
right?
Like it's just this, like, it's like for a while there, I knew people that would just kind of use Kirby to refer to a game that was too easy. And it's like, do you mean a game that's really pretty and really cute and like
designed for children?
This is an extremely pleasant game. Why is pleasantness a bad thing?
Yeah.
So I personally don't like those games, and I do think they're too easy, but I also recognize I'm not the audience.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, it's not made for me. And so I'm not going to complain that it exists. I'd be super happy if they patched in like a harder mode. Mm-hmm. Then I'd go ahead and play it. Hardcore Kirby.
I can't even process hard.
There's even a thing right now where, like, people are trying to push as a counter narrative to the Sekiro narrative to say that Yoshi's Crafted World should have a hard mode. Like, that's a thing. There's a petition, I think. It's exhausting.
I'd be cool if they want to patch in a hard mode. Like, I played the demo. I was like, okay, this is not for me. But if they patch in a hard mode, fine, whatever. I'd be cool with it. I'm not going to cry if they patch in a hard mode. Sure.
No, it doesn't compromise the game in any way. It's providing a satisfying experience to a larger amount of people. I'm fine with that.
Yeah, like...
That should be the end.
I think, like, sometimes I think we're a little glib about this, and, you know, patching in these things or creating different game modes does require resources. You know, coding, QA testing, etc. And I understand games are made with finite resources. So if people are like, you know, the devs owe it to us to make this game easier, to make this game harder, or patch in these different modes, that's where I sort of jump off the train. But just the concept of putting these things in doesn't bother me.
I do believe that there is a legitimate, like, I think to some extent, ethical obligation for just generally accessibility. And accessibility means a billion different things. Accessibility can be as simple as your game did have fucking subtitles in it. What's wrong with you?
Wow.
Like, there are still games that don't do that for whatever reason.
That's
a necessity for me, and I'm not from a standpoint of I need to hear it, but because there's so many times where I just don't hear things in games. I've got weird hearing, and I mean, you've got to have, especially cutscenes, subtitle. I can't believe when people don't do that. It feels so weird.
So, and I recognize that, like, yeah, especially for indie developers, yeah, there's limited resources, and I get that. You know, yeah, maybe once your game is a hit, if it is a hit, and God knows Cuphead was kind of always kind of going to be a hit, like, that was never in question. As soon as the reactions to it started coming out, like, you can do shit with that, you know. You're receiving the profit now. You make good use of it, you know?
Funky mode makes the game harder for me.
Funky mode's, yeah. Funky mode's a whole other.
One thing I wanted to bring up, because I felt directly attacked by it, was the tweet that everybody has had lots of fun destroying about you cheated not only the game but yourself. You didn't grow. You didn't improve. You took a shortcut and gained nothing. You experienced a hollow victory. Nothing was risked and nothing was gained. It's sad that you don't know the difference.
I love how you read it like a poem.
taking it back to Gamers Rise Up, right? This is the same kind of vein, right, of where this kind of thing comes from. But I think probably my third AVC AD back in the channel days topic was how to cheat in video games, right? I run Cheat Engine. I subscribe to Cheat Happens. I love to cheat in games, not just for games that I replay, right? Because sometimes I want to go back and jump back into Dragon Age Origins, but I don't want to mess with the fade, right? So I'll mod out the fade. little things like that, I'm comfortable
with. I think
with
everybody who mods the game mods out the Fade.
Yeah, I think I might be literally the only Dragon Age fan who likes the Fade levels, but that's a whole other conversation.
Oh, I like the Fade in Inquisition. In Origins, not so much.
I love the Origins Fade. I mean, it gets repetitive on repeat playthroughs, sure, but
it's too long. I like the concept, it's just too long.
And a lot of backtracking.
I like Grime.
I like to cheat in games. I identify things that are like, let's say, for example, I know I'm going to have to grind 1,000,000 gold in this game. And the only way to do it isn't necessarily through doing things through experience, but going on and doing things that I don't enjoy. I'll cheat. I'll put in a cheat engine and I'll pop in some gold. And I'm fine with that. I've never, like, I think a lot of people have said, you know, right now it's not that there's not enough games I want to play. There's no time to play them, you know? And if I can identify a shortcut that doesn't ruin my enjoyment of the game, I'm going to do it. I mean, straight up, I'm replaying through Ace Combat 7 right now, and I'm having to go get all the weird, do this very specific thing in order to unlock this skin, right? I beat the game totally fine on my own. I beat it on hard. But what I'm doing right now is I'm just freezing the time so that I don't have to feel rushed in order to get these objectives done, right? I've already beat it. I've already won it. I just want to get the skin. I have to replay it. I can even do it on easy. So it's actually easier if I want to replay it. But I think some of that is just what you're comfortable with doing in a game. I've never had a problem with cheating. I've always looked at it as something that, you know, if the game isn't going to value my time, well, then I'm not going to value its time. You know, I'm just going to do what I need to do to get what I feel like I want to do done.
So that's sort of where I'm at with Sekiro right now. And I'm kind of on the verge of downloading the cheat engine for it. My only issue is I don't want to give myself infinite health. I just want to, like, double my health.
Yeah, or, like, yeah. You can do stuff like that.
The cheat engine doesn't allow for it yet because it's very new.
Yeah, I mean, if it's in tables, sometimes they'll do stuff like it'll let you freeze your health or double it, or if you can find cheat engine, I'm really good with it, so maybe I can help you later. But yeah, I mean, there's little things you can do with it that I think are it's a powerful tool. And like I said, cheat happens is also another really good if you want to just automate that and not have to deal with tables. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know where that guy was going with that tweet. I think everybody's been saying, if I'm proud of a game and I enjoy a game, I want everyone to play it, cheat or not, you know, experience it. And then maybe you liked it. And, you know, if this guy really did power through to the final boss for his review, but was struggling with it, then yeah, man, get past it if that's what you want to do and keep going.
I think what makes it most ridiculous for me is this reviewer legitimately beat everything else except for the final boss. Yeah. Like, it's not like this reviewer gave up. This reviewer struggled through the entire thing.
And it's also part of his job.
Except for the end.
Yeah, he's got to write about the ending. It's part of his job. You know, it's easy to tell your friend, oh, keep trying, you'll get it eventually. It's like, nah, man, I got a deadline. I got to get this done.
Like, the whole weird thing about this for me, like, the whole reaction where they're like, oh, they should put it in easy mode because the game's journalist mode. But if you go to Metacritic, there's literally just one negative review of Sekiro. Mm-hmm. Literally just one.
Oh yeah, they're critical darlings to all the Souls
critics
series
love from software and
yeah. So it's, I don't know what they're getting at. The like, games journalists like this game.
Yeah.
Why are they angry?
They're going through the unpatched version that also has no guides and shit up yet. Like
that's very important. I think playing a hard game with no guides, with nothing else to go through, is a totally different experience.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm absolutely using guides for Bloodborne. I'm not going to apologize for that.
Oh yeah, before I encounter a boss in Sekiro, or I'll do it like cold the first time, but I'm not going to waste time figuring it out the second time. I'll just look up a boss guide, honestly. Mm-hmm. I'm saving myself the trouble because I don't want to, you know, throw myself against a wall and keep losing XP over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think that's completely fine. That's how I want to play the game, because I really love a lot of other things about this game. I love the environment design. I love the way the levels are sort of put together. I just don't want to keep throwing myself against that wall. And so in order to make the game more fun for myself, this is how I'm doing it. And if it makes other people sad that I'm doing it this way, well, they can fucking deal with it, you know?
Yeah, that's completely fair.
Yeah. Like, and I get that, you know, this, maybe I'm disrespecting the the developer's artistic vision, and I'm completely willing to deal whatever the consequences of that are. But also, if it's their artistic vision is still, you know, something that can be critiqued. Just saying, oh, it's this way because their artistic vision, like, you know, we critique films, video films, TV, books all the time. And
yeah, the existence,
you know,
of the vision is not a defense from criticism of it.
Absolutely. That's the best existence
of Zack Snyder.
Yeah. Or like literally even more like celebrated artists, we still critique their work.
Yeah.
You know? And the other thing is, one more thing I was gonna say is that, you know, they talk about you know, books not having an easy mode. Like, if you buy like a bound volume of Shakespeare, it comes with annotations these days, and nobody's like, oh, these annotations are disrespecting the artistic integrity of William Shakespeare.
I do wish that there was a better education system in place for learning Old English, but that's my beef. That has nothing to do with the fact that annotation should still be there for sure. Braille should be there. You know,
I think about things like challenging like movies, right? For example, I don't know, Tree of Life, or you know what I mean, something that like not necessarily everybody's going to be able to sit through and get through and understand, and you know, all at once. How do you review those types of things? Because for a while, you know, with film critics now, it's kind of like, okay, you're either going to see this movie or not, and this is really for the people who are interested in it, at least. I think with games, I don't think you have that kind of shorthand, because it's a medium that still needs to sell as many as it does. I think From's in a good position right now where they can make the games as hard as they want, and they'll still sell pretty well, you know?
It's sold 2 million copies so far, which is very good.
So yeah. I think the sales are always going to be there as long as From doesn't make any huge missteps, but it sounds to me like there's a little bit going around Sekiro that I didn't see with Bloodborne, where it sounds a little bit different, where it's like, yeah, this is difficult, and it's also maybe not a fun difficult for a change.
Yeah. Those systems that you described, Merv, definitely seem significantly more unreasonable and less overall accessible than my experience has been. Admittedly,
I should point out, this is just my experience. For some people, the game has really clicked, but I will say from casual observation, the discourse around this compared to the Souls games and Bloodborne has been a lot more, I don't want to say vitriolic, but definitely more polarized in terms of how people are reacting to its difficulty.
I
think so too.
It's really, and it's making me think that it's not just me, there's some fundamental problems with how the game is designed, and it's taken me a little while of playing through the game to kind of identify what those problems are and what those frustrations are, and you know, what's fair and what isn't. And you know, things like enemies doing a lot of damage to you is a little bit of a red herring. It's more like, you know, the repetition, the tedium, you know, things, attacks not being telegraphed very well, things like that are what kind of tank it for me.
In terms of the difficulty I most enjoy, or difficult things I most enjoy, I really like group efforts, group problem solving type things. I think the most difficult things that I enjoyed the most were probably early WoW and even EverQuest raids, you know, where it's not just difficult for you to do your job, but you're also coordinating, you know, 20 to 30 other people to do it. That's the kind of difficulty I really enjoy even to this day, is, you know, the raid and raid style encounter, the raid style environment, where it's everyone doing their job in kind of a very specific way, and getting it right and seeing it all come together with everybody getting, you know, showered with loot or whatever you want to say. To me, that's a very hard difficulty to pull off, right? Because it's easy to do the shitty way, which is what I think, going back to Kick Anthem one more time, is what it does, where it's just, hey, okay, now we're going to give...
Here's a puzzle in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, and to make it harder, we're going to give the enemies 3,200 times more health and do 3,200 times more damage and deal with it, right? And then, you know, you start to see other games that have dealt with that difficulty of how do we, you know, present a challenge to 4 or 5 or 6 other people, or in WoW's case, you know, 20 other people, how do we make something hard for that many people? I think is a really cool thing to do. And mechanics in MMOs, I think difficulty mechanics MMOs are some of the greatest things to study if you want to learn, I think, where you can get difficulty wrong and right. Some of the early days of raiding in WoW were just, you know, very simplistic tank and spanks or what they call them. And then, you know, you evolve towards, you know, things like the Four Horsemen fight in Naxxramas, you know, stuff like that, I think is when you really started to see difficult mechanics come into MMOs. And that's something I really enjoy in terms of I feel like at the end of one of those fights, I've done something.
And to further to your point about coordination, the places where I've enjoyed like difficult things in games have been generally co-op.
Mm-hmm.
So like Payday, some of the heists are fairly difficult, but when you pull it off with a group of friends, you know, it builds that sense of camaraderie, and mm-hmm. It almost feels like you're overcoming a big feat with people you're close to. It brings you closer together. Another one that's been really good was some of the harder levels in the Portal 2 co-op.
Yeah,
the Portal 2 co-op is so fun.
Yeah, they're really fun. Like, I played it with... actually, this was shortly after I'd graduated college. I moved to a different city than the rest of my friends. I moved to the United States. So I was missing all my friends, and with a couple of friends back home in Canada, I played the Portal 2 co-op, and that was sort of kept me connected to people that I'd left behind. So that was, you know, it was not only fun to reconnect with those people, but also we overcame this challenge together. And to this day, they're still close friends of mine.
Yeah, so one of my favorite experiences is Halo Legendary on co-op. I mean, yes. It sounds so simple, but yes. one of the things that like Halo does, for example, is like they take grunts and give them, you know, plasma cannons, right? Like that's how they change difficulty, and it's still the same old grunt that you can kill in two headshots, but all of a sudden now he's more deadly, and he's something that, you know, when you're looking at the field of stuff you've got to take down, maybe he becomes a priority where, you know, on a lower difficulty you didn't. But Halo Legendary is, I mean, honestly, a co-op experience that's tuned just right in terms of difficulty, I think it's harder to beat that. And I know Halo is my favorite series and all, but I really think if you're looking to just sit down on a couch with a buddy and just tear through a game that you guys find hard but fun, that'd be a really good example of one that you can do that with.
No, I haven't played Halo in 5-ish years, and I still have the fondest memories of Halo co-op. Sorry, Merv, go ahead.
That's good to hear.
No. It's really funny to me imagining, like, you're talking with the little Covenant gun stuff.
Yeah.
The guns that, like, run away and get scared. They go, like,
they'll
be running around. Yeah, running around with a gun bigger than them.
Trying to imagine those guys being super deadly now, and it's hilarious.
They suicide bomb a lot. That was never fun.
They add a lot of stuff to the AI that I think that carried over into games. Like, I think Bungie carried over into things like Destiny, where when the AI gets low, instead of just doing the same old thing, hiding behind cover, or they'll flank you, they'll throw grenades, they'll suicide.
Oh, that's awesome.
They really change up how the AI acts on higher difficulties. One of the skulls, you know, in Halo, there's ways to artificially increase difficulty. If you want one of the skulls, basically every time you throw a grenade, they jump out of the way. They run on the other side of the screen. They know when the grenade is coming and know how to react to it. It's cool when you can put that kind of difficulty in an AI to react differently, where it's not just, you know, okay, well, the more difficult part is that it's you got to shoot it more. Bullet sponge to me is the laziest form of difficulty.
Yeah, so that goes back to what I was saying earlier about difficulty taking up, you know, QA resources. This is something that they needed to really put the effort into. If you're tweaking the AI, a higher difficulty levels or lower difficulty levels, that's something that requires some investment. And it sounds like Bungie pulled it off.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, they have
343's continue. I want to give them a little.
Yeah,
they're still good.
Oh yeah, 343.
Halo Bonnie 5 Ross had some really folks. Good AI. They might have built off of what Bungie set up, but Halo 5, it feels really cool to play, at least the campaign and the co-op. I've heard a lot of mixed complaints about multiplayer, but I haven't really got into that. But the campaign is really good.
Yeah, and apparently it's all coming to PC soon.
Yeah,
it's Halo 5,
man.
Or that's gonna be good for me, because I'm someone who really likes the mechanics of Halo, even if I don't... I've only played through the first campaign, and, you know, I've made my opinions clear on it. I really like the mechanics, don't like the level design, but I've heard that subsequent Halo games really, like, up the
up the level design and make it really good. So I'm actually psyched to play through the campaigns of all of them.
It'll be interesting to see it from an outsider's perspective, from someone who doesn't have a lot of the nostalgia kind of, you know, powering their playthroughs. I think it'd be interesting to see what you think about Halo as a series. I think it gets a lot of kind of, I think in a lot of people's minds, it's a bro game that bros played at the time, but I think it gets a lot of short shrift in how it's looked at for its place in gaming. God, I hated you guys dumping it so early in those stupid tournaments. It's crazy.
I don't touch the tournaments. I do not touch one the tournaments.
I think people, and I've defended Halo. I mean, I've been very critical of some parts of Halo, don't get me wrong. But I will say, I don't think people really appreciate its legacy, and they think of its legacy as the copycat games that came afterwards and didn't understand what made Halo's mechanics work so well. Like the two weapon limit and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. That works very well with the rest of Halo's mechanics. Shooters adopted it without thought.
Even the shield mechanic. I mean, think about the shield mechanic in the shooters now. It's everywhere. I mean, it used to be you would take a shot and then you had to go look around for and hunt for a health pack, you know? That shield mechanic is genius. It just keeps the action flowing. And I think somebody talked about, I think I talked about this before maybe, is that Halo was always designed to basically be like an encounter, a pause, an encounter, and pause. And then like instead of like being set PC, like Call of Duty is, right? And then you've got the different engagement ranges. Okay, I shoot at these guys with my long range. Then I throw a grenade. Then I shoot it with my short range. Now I'm punching. And like when you start to see that design theory go into the maps and design and stuff, it feels really cool. Because you know you close the distance. You use different abilities, different skills, different weapons. It makes you think: do I carry a shotgun or do I carry a sniper? You know, those are the types of
And those are strategic choices that are very reflected in Halo's design. And a lot of the elements that people took from Halo's design, they didn't account for those strategic possibilities. Mm-hmm. So I'll put a two-weapon limit in a game where you need to be constantly switching weapons. Or I'll put a two-weapon limit in a game where it doesn't mean anything because you're just going to use the assault rifle for everything anyway. Whereas Halo actually does have these strategic choices that you do need to make. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think people sort of, I should say they underrate Halo's legacy because they are thinking of the bad design ideas it inspired rather than the good design ideas in the original game.
Yep.
But you know, that's just how I feel about Halo in general. So to bring us back to challenge, are there any other challenges that you folks have enjoyed overcoming in video games that you want to mention?
There was that one boss in Kingdom Hearts 2. I can't remember his name now, but he had the water come up out of the floor and chase you around. Anybody? Anybody?
I don't remember because I'm playing through the Kingdom Hearts series, like the whole thing right now, and I'm still on Chain of Memories.
It looks like you're really doing the deep dive.
Demix?
Demix. Yes, sure.
I think we have an avocado poster with that name, right?
Yes.
Yeah, there you go.
Oh, well, all right.
And she also plays lots of video games.
She sure does.
That boss fight was just a nightmare for whatever reason. I can't remember now. It was probably a decade ago that I played it, but it was a nightmare. And I remember when I finally beat him, I put that game down for like 2 weeks and didn't come back to it because I had been so fed up.
If it makes you feel better, you're not alone, because the answer on GameFAQs is, in my entire career as a gamer, this was the hardest boss I have ever fought. So you're not alone.
It's so weird that the Kingdom Hearts games are difficult because it just doesn't match Disney aesthetic. Yeah.
No, I watched the library last fight the Merv. You'll know what I'm talking about here. Fight the Riku boss fight in Kingdom Hearts 1 on Story So Far Collection. She did that fight probably 30 times, and she never beat it. And she just we're just selling this game. I'm done with this shit.
Riku took me because I made the mistake of not playing on beginner. I decided to play on normal because that's what the game recommended to me, and I usually play games on normal. And that was a mistake. It took me, I think, several hours over 3 days to beat the final boss.
just because.
Yeah, she didn't even get to the final boss.
No, there's like an entire dungeon between the Riku boss fight and the final boss.
I know, yeah.
It's friggin' brutal.
It's interesting that you bring up JRPG bosses, though, Admirex, because I was thinking earlier of what I think the hardest boss was that I think now people probably wouldn't understand, but it was Emerald Weapon at the time. Because if you played Final Fantasy back then, when there weren't a lot of guides, unless you went and bought the stupid book or called, you know, the Nintendo help line, there were guides, you know, and those weapons, Emerald and Ruby, were very hard trying to figure out exactly what the game wanted you to do. Of course, you know, miming Knights of the Round was a big part of it, but I was still like, well, you know, what do I do? How come my guys keep getting blown off in between? And all these little mechanics that I didn't understand at the time were, you know, kind of gimmicky if you found out what you actually had to do. But yeah, I remember that being one of those things where that was the first time within a JRPG where I was like, I don't know how to beat this boss. And there was no internet really for me to go look. And luckily, I think I had a friend who did have Nintendo Power. So he brought it over to my house and he's like, hey, dummy, kill yourself. I'm like, what? And that ended up working.
Yeah. So it's interesting that in the age of the internet now, because you can just go look up guides, in some ways I feel like developers have kind of responded to this and kind of upped the ante for a lot of games, where now, you know, just looking up a guide isn't enough. You can't just cheese your way through a boss fight. You gotta like learn the patterns and learn how to execute all the maneuvers. It's not just a matter of looking up how to do something.
There's can I talk about one that I thought was something?
Yeah, go ahead.
For me, it's not an individual part of a game, but it's kind of, I really, really like, actually it's kind of two things. I really like Punch-Out, I really like Pikmin, and I actually like them for more or less the same reasons. I think they're kind of, especially the bosses in Pikmin are, once you kind of get it, the tells are all there and it's beautiful. Like in Pikmin 3, there's a, it's like a little bee conductor and it's adorable, but it conducts bees, and the bees are a nightmare if you don't, and it almost, they're a nightmare. In
like
this
a
way.
Musical orchestral conductor?
He's got the little.
It's called the maestro. Yeah.
Yes. And yeah, so he kind of like, he or she kind of like conducts these bees, and the bees at first, there's almost no pattern to it. Like feels like chaos because there's so many of them, it's hard to kind of get a thing out. But once you kind of know what's going on, it's like the easiest boss in the game. But knowing what's going on means doing it several times, like it and it's just, it's really, really cool, and I really like that one. And that was one where I was just like, beating it made me feel like a genius, and I kind of get the same thing out of Punch-Out. Like I just really like stuff like that, where it's like, this is impossible, oh wait, I'm a genius. Like, that's kind of where I am with
stuff. I just started Punch-Out NES on my Switch a couple days ago, and it took me a solid hour to get through fucking, what's his face, Von Kaiser.
Oh yeah.
I blazed through Piston Honda in one try, and that
Punch-Out
felt like the best
NES
thing ever.
Punch-Out NES and Super Punch-Out are so much easier once you've played the Wii, because the Wii one, the tells are a little more obvious, but they're the same tells.
Yeah, I've
so
never played
kind of
any
like,
Punch-Out games.
Okay, no, the Wii one is I really like it. I really like all of them, but like once I kind of got a handle on the Wii one, it's like, oh, these are all the same. I can do this now. Okay. But
You can learn the pattern. Speaking of overcoming a challenge, making you feel like a genius... I'm currently playing through Baba Is You. This really complicated puzzle game. I described it on the last episode, so I won't go into detail here. But that game is fucking brutally difficult. So every time I figure out how to solve a puzzle just by putting together the mechanics, it makes me feel like a fucking genius. I do like scientific research for a living. So this is harder than that shit. So
one thing I wanted to bring up real quick. I was talking earlier about MMO difficulty and stuff like that, and talking a little bit about how things have changed too in terms of guides. Back when we used to get, you know, I was in like a big raiding guild. We had, you know, world first and stuff like that. Not bragging, just set in the stage, but when we would kill a boss, we wouldn't post videos. We wouldn't tell people how we did it. It became like a state secret. You know, even when we would proof what we call proof of kill shots, it would literally be like the boss in a corner with everything else cropped out so people wouldn't know how we positioned the boss. Now, you know, within hours, top tier raiding guilds in MMOs are posting exactly how to fight bosses. You can find strats for basically every type of game you want online in 2 seconds. So I think you're right in saying that games have to come up with new ways of difficulty that they previously couldn't, because so many games have become easy once someone gives you the blueprint, right?
Yeah.
Go here, do this, use this ability, do this, you'll win. And I think what From has done masterfully is take the difficulty away from that portion of it and instead put it on, well, you got to just be good enough at dodging or parrying, or, you know, yeah, you can try builds that make certain things harder or easier, but at the same time, if you're not getting the core mechanics down, you're not going to get past this part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, honestly, yeah. I tried playing, when I was playing Cuphead, I had to look up a couple of boss guides because I said, I must be missing something. I can't keep dying this much. And I think the polygon guide, I can't remember which boss it was, but they said, you know, you have to watch out for this move and this move, and basically, good luck. You're going to need it.
Yeah. Cuphead's a good one where it's like, well, there's the tell. Now I got to figure out what to do from here.
Yeah. Now I just have to get good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those experience I've had, I never actually completed the game with Potto Box, because even knowing, Potto Box is a lot like Punch Out, by the way. But even knowing the tells, I just couldn't execute the moves or the counters fast enough, because I just don't have the reflexes. Sekiro is not so bad. There's a little bit more time with the tell, so you can eventually get good enough. It's just frustrating to get there.
But it's interesting to see that evolve from like where it used to be like very specific ways to beat very specific things. But once the culture of YouTubes and, you know, everything else, that style of difficulty just doesn't fly anymore. I mean, it really doesn't. It's just like, you know,
like the old style of find the one thing that the boss is weak to and just cheese it.
Yeah.
Like that's still like the only games that still do that, I think, are Persona, where you just find the boss weakness and you just repeat that strategy over and over again until you win.
Roll through Ganon's legs.
They're definitely. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, roll through Ganon's legs and you're done.
Yeah, so like the whole you know, being able to cheese a boss, you can't really do that so much anymore. I mean, there's still strats that work and strats that don't, but yeah, no more boss cheesing, which is a double-edged sword. Anything else you guys want to mention before we call this podcast to a close?
Man, are we exactly at 2 hours? That is impressive, guys. Oh man, this might be an all-star cast. I don't think we've ever done this before.
Yeah, we managed to be efficient. We managed to cover a lot of ground. We talked about GTA 5 role-playing. We talked about challenging games. We talked about Donkey Kong Tropical Freeze.
Talk about gamers rising up. Don't forget
we
that.
We talked about how we all live in a society.
We all do live in a society, and we all live in Los Angeles, the greatest city in the world. Sponsored by, what did I call it, the fake
yellow
service?
Yellow Spoon.
Yellow Spoon. I mean, it's totally real, guys. Do you really think a company would use Baby Let's Spoon Tonight as its slogan?
Oh, man, I wish.
Nowadays?
I think we're getting,
yeah, I could,
2019.
I could see that.
2019, I mean,
yeah.
Wendy's is an asshole, so.
If, you know, our careers don't work out, we'll all band together and start a meal kit delivery service with the slogan "Baby, Let's Spoon Tonight." We'll be on all the podcasts. You know, Earwolf, Rooster Teeth, hit us up. We're gonna.
I want to be an EA influencer. Don't ruin that dream for me.
Yeah, I want to get exclusive access to like the new Madden.
Oh yeah, that's football. That's such a verb.
Yeah. I don't get stereotyped as having like a kind of game.
I don't know, man. I think it's hard.
I play shooters. Nobody's like, oh yeah, Wolfenstein is such a Merv game.
Actually, now you mentioned.
I've only played Donkey Kong for 6 years. So like,
I just remember you talking about football one time, and I think you used, like, I can't remember what it was, but I think you were asking questions about it. That's why I mentioned Madden specifically.
You know what? I've never actually played Madden. I've played FIFA before, because, like, I've had roommates who are just, like, super, super into it, and they're, like, fucking FIFA wizards. But I'm total shit at FIFA. I can't play that
game. My brother only ever played basketball games, so that's the only thing I've experienced.
Yeah, my brother.
NES hockey is great.
I've played some of, like, the really old PS1 or PS2 hockey games where you can get into hockey fights, and then it turns into, like, a weird, like, two-player punch-out kind of thing.
Blades of Steel, I think that was that one.
Like, it's even in, I think, the NHL games where it's just, like, a hockey fight mode in there for no reason.
Well, man, I forgot about that.
Yeah. So if ever you want to, like, pick up a really old game where you can pretend to be Ty Domi and beat up Radek Bonk, go ahead and do it. You can tell that I haven't watched hockey in, like, 15 years, because those are the hockey players I'm naming.
You didn't make those names up.
Yeah, I was going to think, like, oh, that's...
Ty Domi is a very famous Leafs player, and Radek Bonk played for the Ottawa Senators.
Okay, fair enough. I thought those were made up.
And then I moved to the United States and stopped following hockey.
I think my favorite hockey name that sounds made up is Sandis Ozalinch. Remember him?
What?
He was like... Yeah.
Wow, that's a hot name.
That's a great fucking name.
Yeah, it is. Very hockey.
Bobson Dunnett.
Make sure that he gets
So you know that name is like totally made up, but it's also amazing. My contribution to the world was taking that screenshot, and I think I edited out Anatoly Smorin to read Ansel Elgort.
Yeah, I remember. And so many people didn't question it.
And nobody, like, I've posted that in so many places, and everyone's just like, why are you posting the same screenshot again? nobody realized.
When Colton Burpo, that kid who saw God, when that kind of circulated, the screen cap that started circulating, somebody had changed his name to Brumbo Tumpkus. and everybody's like, is his name Brumbo Tumpkus? Because it's like, Brumbo Tumpkus and Colton Burpo were kind of on the same level as far as, like, this could go either way.
Yeah, we're pretty accepting of weird things sometimes. And just to close us off, if you'd like to keep up to date with the podcast, we have a website, avocadogamescast.wordpress.com. We post every episode. We post a link dump. We post a fact check inside the link dump. And we actually do try to fact check stuff we say. I think the last link dump had a record 6 or 7 corrections. I might have to correct this in this link dump because I might be wrong about the number of corrections.
The owl boss is not named Mr. Hootie. That's not right. I'll just say that now.
Turns out we don't live in a society.
That's going to be the name of the podcast now.
We don't live in a society. That's your fault, Admirax. You gave us the episode title. So you can also subscribe to us on iTunes or Google Play Music. Just search for Avocado Gamescast. And we've mentioned a lot of usernames and names that sound fake. Those are the usernames of people on The Avocado, which is the community that spawned this podcast. So go to the-avocado.org. Don't actually type the word hyphen. Type the character hyphen, because typing the word hyphen, why would you even do that? I don't know why you'd think.
We should probably snag that URL while we have the chance.
That's pretty good.
Hyphen avocado. I realized the other day that, like, The Avocado without the hyphen was just like a domain that somebody had parked on.
Yep.
And there's no actual website there. So we're a bunch of rubes because we could have, like, snagged that up.
That's not even the first time you've said that in this podcast.
Yeah, he's really, really hardcore on it.
Struck a nerve.
Yeah, I'm sorry, guys. I'm shitty about this.
You're fine.
Yeah. And anyway, thank you all for being on the podcast. And thank you all for living in a society with me.
Hey, thank you so much,
take care,
everyone.
Folks.
That was wonderful.
Yeah, that was great.
Yeah. I feel like we could do a whole other hour on
that's a really good
society.
It's a really good one, Murph.
Yeah. Let's not. All right, take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Have a good day.